for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Outstealing Horses is a novel by Per Perdison. It's the story of a 67-year-old Oslo professional who moves to an isolated cabin in far eastern Norway after the death of his wife and sister. He intends to live out the rest of his days in quiet reflection. But a chance meeting with his only neighbor triggers unsettling memories of a summer 50 years earlier when he stayed in a similar cottage with his father. Joining me in the studio for this month's Reader's Review, author and editor Jeffrey Frank, Deirdre Donahue, she's book critic for USA Today, and Eric Hofton, he's chairman of a Norwegian video game company. I hope many of you have read this book, but if you haven't, feel free to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
I'm going to start with you, Eric Hofton, since you are a Norwegian citizen, perhaps a citizen of the United States as well. Tell us what you thought of this book.
Well, I read it a second time now in English after having first read it in Norwegian a few years ago, and I found it it made a big impression on me the first time, and maybe even a bigger the second time when I read it with kind of the stripped of the Norwegian associations with the English language version.
What kind of impression?
Well, it's about the big universal questions in life, and it's about a father and his son and making sense of life and making sense of what happened to his father and his relationship to his father. So it's pretty universal. It's easy to identify with.
Easy to identify with from your point of view, Jeffrey Frank.
Well, it's a classic coming-of-age novel, and I just thought, and I think that, so I think any man who's ever been 15 years old will certainly know sort of everything that Trond went through, and it's an extraordinary book. Trond is a central character who is parts of Per Pedersen are in Trond, though obviously not a good deal of Pedersen. Pedersen is 10 years younger than Trond and so on.
But Trond decides to leave the world behind. We don't quite understand in the beginning why.
Yeah. Well, he's had an experience that is not entirely unlike the one that Pedersen himself had. Pedersen himself, in 1990, the Scandinavian Star, a ferry boat that went from Frederikssund in Denmark to Oslo, caught fire and burned. 500 people were on the ferry. 100 people died. 4 of them were from Per Pedersen's family. His father died, his mother died, a brother, and then the niece of another younger brother who had died earlier. So there's something in him when you learn very a little on in the book that his wife and his sister died in a car crash, and a horrendous car crash that made the papers and so on. There's a reference to it later of some photographer won a prize taking a picture of this overturned Audi, and so this sort of sense of foreboding and personal tragedy sort of comes from almost from the very first page.
Deirdre Donahue, what did you think of the book?
I'm afraid I am gender impaired because this book did nothing for me. And
really?
I know it's won all sorts of prizes. It's been, you know, the New York Times, one of the top 10 books of 2007. Absolutely at every point, I did not understand the motivations of the characters. I recognize it is very much a 15-year-old boy. But that has not kept me from reading other books and feeling I can understand them. I found the motivation in the characters did not ring true to me, and I didn't feel that The father's behavior. I don't know how much should we get into the plot of the
film. Absolutely. Okay,
no, I will say, okay, I did think the opening with the tragedy involving the two 10-year-old twins where, you know, he has this very, you know, the book opens and it's like this dynamic, fun, really sort of slightly bad guy, John. And John, you know, they go out stealing horses, you know, and Tron is very taken with him. And he obviously has John is this really kind of, you know, he teaches him how to roll logs. He's just up. He's 15 and he's alive. And he's really bringing Tron with him. And they go along. And then I do think the tragedy involving the twins, because Tron likes to shoot. He's a hunter. And he's all male. And he proceeds to, they're going out, but something is wrong with John. And he's like, Tron gets thrown from the horse, and then they go up and they look at the golden finch bird, and it's beautiful and magical, and then the kid crushes it. And it's a
gripping,
shocker. I kept thinking, psychopath? You know, no. Then it turns out that Tron's father explains that John, earlier, I guess the previous day, had gone out. Had gone out and, in fact, left his gun. And they have two little boys, Lars and Odd. And he ends up, Lars shoots the brother in the heart. And it's obviously a devastating tragedy. And I thought that was very effective. But then I just simply, there were too many coincidences. I didn't find the whole mystery involving like Tron's father and John's mother. The World War II
didn't make sense to you. Why were you shaking your head?
The twin happened the day happened after he crushed the nest, and after that he never saw John again. You really don't know what motivated John to do that, and you realize later it's because John's. It's absolutely not entirely clear, but it's because John's mother's having an affair. With Tron's father. And he never speaks about it. Tron kind of senses it, and that's sort of always in the background, and it's been there since the war. The war is also in the background. John's father didn't take part of the resistance. Tron's father did. And the war, for every Norwegian, actually Eric can speak about this much more than I can, but for every Norwegian, the war is, even today, 65 years after the Nazis were thrown out, it's still with every Norwegian.
Eric.
It certainly is, and that really shows in this book, I think. But I frankly agree a bit with you, Deirdre. I have an 8-year-old son. And I've been very preoccupied about thinking about being a role model for him. And there aren't many role models in this book. The men there are—you wouldn't want to be like them. And
well, isn't it interesting that Tron's father also went off and left his family behind?
It is. He repeats his father's mistakes and does the same to his children and his family.
And that's why you're very disappointed in this novel.
I'm sorry. I have to be upfront with you. John's mother, I know she's beautiful. I know she's, you know, but I mean, you do have the scene where, you know, I believe they've just buried the 10-year-old twin. I can believe, and then she's out there, and they're either haymaking or the, you know, chopping wood, all the stuff, and the lumber. John and his father are not there, but somehow 3 days after she's buried her 10-year-old twin, she is still able to sort of be dynamic. Then there's like issues, I guess. I just have to say that the grief that I think any woman would feel about the loss of her twin. All three children have been damaged. I cannot understand that in 1940 Norway, with a very strong Lutheran morality, I believe, that she would not have sensed any sort of guilt. I felt it didn't ring true to me historically.
Could it have been her expression of grief that turned her to Tron's father?
Well, I believe so. Remember, they had the relationship probably going far back to the war, having experienced quite a bit together, and that was probably her true love, the love of her life,
far more than her own husband.
Yes.
From whom she did not get a great deal of attention, sympathy, warmth. So,
and she also feels, which is very interesting, she feels something for Tron, the 15-year-old, and vice versa. Tran is hugely attracted to her. I would say that her father's, Tran's father's lover is his first crush, and he dreams about her. And in a way, and I think that she has a great affection for him. And in a way, perhaps she's another, he's almost one of her sons too, for the same reason that her affection for John's father, Tran's father is greater than her affection for her own husband.
You know, it strikes me that there are cultural differences here that, despite what the New York Times said about how wonderful this book is, how beautifully written it is, there are cultural differences here that may be difficult for some of us to appreciate, Deirdre.
But now, since you're Norwegian, I would like to know, in 1940, rural Norway, if a woman has had one, would her husband, sullen, unpleasant husband, have allowed her to race off to be a resistance fighter, going back and forth, endangering her family, and also obviously having an affair? And that I keep thinking that her husband was going to take an axe and kill Tran's father.
Well, from in general, I think maybe they would in Norway at that time. I think the resistance movement was above everything else.
So strong.
Yes,
so
I think
important.
It was. But to this particular case, this husband of hers, I don't think he was capable of taking an axe and
he
doing
wasn't,
this.
He wasn't capable of much in the way of feeling at all, which might have driven him to take an axe in hand. Eric Hofton, he's chairman of a Norwegian video game company. Right back. Welcome back. We're talking about this month's Reader's Review. It's a book by Per Pedersen titled Outstealing Horses. And we have three guests with us in the studio. I hope you'll join us as well. Jeffrey Frank is the author of four novels, co-author of a translation of the stories of Hans Christian Andersen from Danish to English. Previously, he was senior editor at The New Yorker for more than 13 years. Deirdre Donahue is book critic for USA Today. Eric Hofton is chairman of a Norwegian video game company. And our number, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Eric, it makes me wonder whether the translation of this book for you worked as well as reading it in the original Danish.
Well, it made for a very different experience, I think. When you took off all the cultural associations I had with the Norwegian version of it, it became a different book. Because in Norway, we usually say that Norway is maybe a poor language compared to English in some ways. We have fewer words to play with, but when it comes to things described in this book, nature, weather, which play both play an extremely important part in this book. And Norwegian is very rich. And that's kind of, I didn't get that feeling that I had reading the Norwegian book, all the feeling and senses of nature and weather and the important role that plays in the life of Norwegians out in the forest.
Hugely important in this book. And forgive me, are you saying that that played out more importantly in the original Norwegian version or in the English version?
In the Norwegian version, because I have closer associations to the words used, to the expressions used in the Norwegian version. But then, on the other hand, what happened when I read the English version was that I got more into the human drama of it, this relationship between father and son and identified perhaps more closely with it, because I haven't grown up in a timber country background in the eastern Norway. It's a bit foreign for me too. So taking off a bit of this Norwegian frame actually helped me get into the story.
Interesting. Jeffrey Frank, do you think this is basically a man's story?
I don't. I think it's about men. There's a lot of Hemingway in the language, and I think Pedersen, obviously, when he writes lovingly about his chainsaw and writes lovingly about timber, about how to fell logs and so on, perhaps this is more for men. But I just think it is a very, very human story. I was very interested in what Eric had to say about the Norwegian and the English. I just found it the most beautiful Norwegian. He writes this lovely, pure language, which sort of goes back to sort of the great Norwegian writers like Hamsun, without a lot of sort of modernisms, a lot of Americanisms, and so on. It's just a beautiful language, and I was just so struck by that. And I would say the translation was quite good as far as it goes, but the translations are really, really hard.
Here's an email from Edward, who asks, is Out Stealing Horses a man's story? I'm a 61-year-old white male. It's perhaps not surprising. I totally identified with Trond and his fascinating coming-of-age story. Other men also enjoyed the novel after I gave them a copy to read. But it got a negative review from a woman co-worker who did not seem to get the coming-of-age part and was disappointed that more of Trond's story, especially a backstory regarding his relationship with his deceased wife, was not developed. So I began to think of it as primarily a man's story. Then my wife's all-female book club read it, although the reviews were mixed. One or two had the same problem as my coworker. One woman declared it was the best thing she had read in a long time and read it 3 times before the club met. So, Deirdre, you're not out of the mainstream. You are representing one particular.
May I amend my answer? I'm starting to think maybe it is a bit more of a man's book. I can't, since I'm not a woman, I can't judge.
All right. We're going to welcome our listeners into this discussion, since it's a reader's review. And if you've read it or not, we invite you to join us. First, let's go to Concord, New Hampshire. Good morning, Heather. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to call as a woman and say that I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I only read it once, but I think it actually speaks to universal questions of loss and love and life in the face of loss. And I totally disagree with the concept that a great book can't cross cultural and gender barriers to be understood. I mean, I think that this book is a great book, and like many great books, speaks to everyone in all times.
Deirdre.
Well, actually, I mean, I the truth is, maybe it's me individually, and I really do not believe. Like, for example, among my favorite books are Lonesome Dove. I actually really like Cormac McCarthy. I loved all the Pretty Horses. It's not. I do really like journey books. I did not find. I also found the narrative very hard to keep track of. For example, I never really the whole thing, like with Lars, that there were so many accidents that suddenly, how is Lars there? Why does Poker keep growling at Lars? That's never addressed. I did not find the fact that I found rather tiresome the endless recitation of him getting up, his clothes, folding his clothes. It's like, can we just move on here?
I thinking about those same paragraphs, Deirdre, I found myself thinking, this fellow is depressed. He's lonely. He has established a way of being for himself that concentrates on details like folding his clothes, like getting up, like how he thinks before he goes to sleep, because that's what keeps him alive. Those are the tiny portions of his life that are real. Everything else is sort of dreamlike.
Yeah, and actually, I think you really got it. He is depressed. He sort of, his big project is basically clearing his driveway at one point. But it isn't just all downward. He reconnects with his daughter late in the book, and that's for real. And you sense that that's going to go on. And she says, "Get a telephone, Pop." And he's going to get. He's probably is going. She didn't even know who he was, and he is going to get a. He's going to get a telephone. He'll probably get a better car. The car in which his wife and sister were killed was probably a pretty good car. He's driving a 10-year-old rear-wheel drive Nissan now, which probably can't even get up the driveway. So he's obviously not obviously, but I think he's. I think there's some hope there. I think he's going to change his life. Maybe he'll even go to Oslo once in a while.
He may. Yeah. He may indeed. Go ahead, Deirdre.
I recognize that you're supposed to see that. You know. His relationship with his father broke his heart. His father is very, very sort of dynamic and a really leader of men. And you can see that he is, in fact, an extraordinary man. And also that his father gives him, his father knows he's out of there. And the father does give him some advice, never be bitter. The concept of, like, whenever he's trying to think of, like, his father actually breaks his heart, but also gives him all the skills that turn him into the man with the golden trousers. Inexplicable phrase, personally, but and the fact that the guy is incredibly successful, he's a very successful businessman, he's very crisp, he is a man who, he got things from John, that ability to jump in without, you know, without thinking. I mean, it is like the things that broke his heart also gave him enormous strength, but of course you see at the end he has repeated the isolation, the emotional, the lack of connection with his daughters. I just have to say that I found it kind of predictable.
How do we interpret that man with the golden trousers phrase?
Well, he must at most of his life have been a very successful person, it seems like, in the book, as it seems. So he doesn't have any complex or problems because of his life succeeding in society and among men. But it is his relations to his closest that's his big challenge and his big problem. And what I think, and of course that's what many say when they've read the book, is the important message you sit back with. It's these final words that we first heard when he was going to clear the nettles around the cabin, and that you are the one who decides if it hurts, that there is room there. Whatever happens to you in life, it's up to you how you react to it and what you make out of it.
All right, let's go to Blairstown, New Jersey. Hello, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Yes, I'd just like to say that I think this is one of the most beautiful books I've read in the last couple years. I'm 62 years old. I'm a woman. I found it totally human, not subject to cultural differences, certainly not about men. I have given away many copies of it. I think that it is so fine. There is such understated pain throughout the whole book that I think it is beautifully written. And I think those details that you were talking about, I think they echo the emptiness in his life. Mm. And as was just said, one of the main lessons about we decide how much it hurts. The other thing that came across to me is the motif of Dickens from David Copperfield, that are we going to be the main characters in our lives? You know, do we have control and do we direct our future? And obviously, this Atron did not have control over the main thing in his life, which was his father leaving him. I think it's a totally human situation.
Jeffrey.
Yeah, I was going to talk about Dickens for a second. Deirdre had mentioned all these sort of weird coincidences, and one thing about Norwegian fiction is, in a country of 3 million people, everyone knows everybody. You are bound to run into someone you know almost anywhere you go.
Interesting.
And that sort of plays out. There was a very famous post-war novel. What was it? It was called Meeting by the Milepost by Sigurd Hoel. Mm-hmm. And it was about all the collaborations and the Nazis, and so every neighbor knew every other neighbor's dark secrets and so on. And mm-hmm. I just think that this novel illuminates so many things about Norway, but also obviously about life in general.
And the novel we're talking about is titled Outstealing Horses, by Norwegian novelist Per Pedersen. It was one of the New York Times Books of the Year in 2007. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Barry. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I've been really enjoying this particular program. I like your show anytime. But,
thank you.
I'm an engineer. I've been an engineer for 50 years, and quite recently I've taken up carving and writing some poetry and beginning to exercise the right side of my brain. And in your discussion, what I observe is that I had not read this book, hadn't even heard of it, but a lot of people have different takes on this book, and I think that is a reflection of the art itself. If it were too plain and clear and logical, everybody would see it the same way. But I think this is a sign that this really is art. That art is mostly a reflection of the observer.
I think that's a good point, and Greta from Arlington has called and says, the book sounds interesting, but I can't follow the discussion. Could someone offer a brief plot summary? That's hard to do with this novel. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's very hard. One of the things that I find so admirable in it as a book and is the artistry he brings to it. There's a lot of shifting in time and place. It opens in 1948. It goes back to the war to 44, 42, not 44, in the sort of heart of the resistance, and then it becomes just before the millennium. And so he's 15 years old. He's 9 years old. He's 17 years old, and now he's 67 years old. And trying to put this all together. But the plot is really he runs into a man, a neighbor of his who looks very vaguely familiar. His name is Lars. Lars turns out to be. Lars turns out to be the man who accidentally shot his twin brother, and that brings back the entire summer of 48, which was really the sort of coming of age moment. When his father left, when so many things happened.
But he spent some time with his father before.
Oh, he did. He
his
did.
His father
he did.
Left.
Oh,
and
he did.
That was a very important period.
Exactly.
In his life, it's also when he discovers his father is having an affair with the neighbor.
Right, right.
The mother of the twin who was accidentally shot. So it really is a novel that is lived through the mind of the central figure and his memories. And that's why the plot is hard to summarize, but in my case, it did carry me along. I did get involved with his memories, his thoughts, his anxieties as a child and as an older man, thinking about how the heck am I going to get out of this driveway if somebody doesn't come along and plow me out?
And just to add one more bit of, not confusion, but to sort of say why this book, I think it is easy to read and follow, but it's hard to summarize, which is...
Exactly. Yeah. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls, your questions, comments. The book is titled Outstealing Horses by Per Pettersen. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day. At wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Hampton Sides talks about his new book, Hellhound on His Trail, the stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the international manhunt for his assassin.
He was a racist. He had talked in prison about how killing King would be a retirement plan for him.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We talk about Outstealing Horses, our April Reader's Review by Per Pettersen. Here's an email from John in Arlington, Virginia. He calls it a very powerful book. He says, oddly enough, living vicariously through the loss of Tron's father had a very positive impact on my relationship with my own 5 and 1 year old sons. It really emphasized the depth and lasting importance of my relationships with them in a way I had never felt so acutely. For weeks after reading this book, I couldn't stop hugging them. It's a powerful comment because he is reacting to the distance that Trond felt eventually after having enjoyed this wonderful relationship with his father and then being abandoned by him. He is moved to care very deeply about his own children. Pardon me. Let's go to Elkin, North Carolina. Good morning, Adrian. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm also a woman. I'm 42 years old. I read this book a little over a year ago, and I loved it. I'm also a pediatrician, and my area of specialty is working with kids with chronic illness, so I've seen a lot of families grieve, and I just wanted to address the point about it not seeming like the mom not seeming, it doesn't seem like that's something you would do after you lost your child. And I think that it, in my own experience, there is no standard thing that people do. People grieve in so many ways, and I love this book, and I just found all the characters fascinating, and I did not find their kind of ways of coping or dealing with their losses, not believable, I guess.
Interesting. Thanks for calling. Any comment from you?
No, I find the book believable, but at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, I find it strangely old-fashioned. It's very firmly rooted in the last century, and as I said, there are a few role models for a modern man and his son, as I'm looking for them for my relationship to my son.
Interesting. Here's an email from Rebecca, who says, regarding John's father, he may not have taken an axe to Tron's father, but he was passive aggressive, did not cover his tracks, and essentially set the Nazis off to kill his wife and lover. Do you believe that?
Well, I'm not sure he did that on purpose. I'm just wondering if it was just he didn't want to put on his shoes and do that. He was the kind of guy who preferred to lie down and wait it out.
What do you think,
consequences?
I agree with Eric. I didn't see. He was passive. He wasn't, and he wasn't very brave. I don't think. But no, I don't see the next thing happening.
She goes on to say, "I was really blown away by the final scene when Tron and his mother go to Sweden to get the money. That was a lot about sons and mothers." Do you recall that scene?
My favorite, the only scene I truly enjoyed or appreciated, that was the one moment where I felt I connected. I totally understood what was happening there. I guess what is my essential crisis with this book is the fact that at no point I look at Tron's father. He's very appealing, very magnetic, obviously brave, yet he is capable. At what he does is unforgivable, and I do not see where this motivation comes from. And in fact, the one graceful moment I thought was when the Tron does not ask Lars, what was it like to grow up with my father? The fact that he doesn't, because in fact, Lars, I never understood. For a character to work, you have to understand what is it? Because, you know, yes, I know it's great sex with Miss Beauty Queen, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, I just have to say, it just didn't ring true to me. Sorry.
It's when Tron and his mother go to Sweden to get the money. This is the money that Tron's father has left for his family. It turns out to be a very minimal amount. And Tron's mother says, we're going to buy you a new suit. And so she takes all the money and buys him a new suit. And Rebecca goes on to say, that was a lot about sons and mother. I felt kicked in the stomach when Tron says to himself how angry he was that his father left him responsible for this woman, Eric.
Yeah, I felt the same way.
Did you?
Yes, I identified with him and could feel his disappointment with his father at that point. And also the what follows right after, and the ending of the book when he stands with his unclenching his fist after almost having hit a fairly innocent bystander who had nothing to do with the story, and looking back at the situation, decides that this is I actually here I made a major decision. I decided about how I would react to this and live the rest of my life in a way.
But this just goes, it's a reminder again of how wonderful, for me, how wonderful this book is. That last scene It's about his mother, but it's also about all the sort of ripples that happened when his father left. It's extraordinarily powerful because it brings back everything all at once. And because it not only his life had changed, but his mother had become a completely different person, and she never recovered from it. She became fat, lazy, intellectually, just everything had collapsed within her and without her. And everything, you pay a price for everything. And that was, and you sort of saw all of it coming together at the end. It was an extraordinary scene. And so it was about mothers and sons. The father is, I'm interested to hear what Eric thinks. There was some talk about a cultural difference and he reminds me of sort of, and I don't want to get too lit-critty here, but he reminds me of someone like Glahn in Hampson's Pan. And I'm just wondering what Eric thinks about.
Well, I think it's a bit telling that you compare him with old Norwegian literature and not modern Norwegian literature. I feel it's kind of a time that will never come back. These men's roles you hear about in this book, and in Norway, of course, is a very equal rights country where men and women have roles that almost are the same now. Where you. Men take care of the kids as much almost as women do in Norway, at least compared to here. And I think that's in some way that's what's irritated me with this book, that you don't get any bearings on modern life on this millennium.
How old is Per Pettersen?
57. He'll be 57. He's 10 years younger than Trond.
And he is still living.
Oh, yeah.
And where is he living? Is he considered a master in Norway?
Well, he is. It's in Norway, you have to go abroad and gain recognition there. Then you definitely are a master in Norway.
Oh, I see. I see.
Certainly, he is. He is highly regarded in Norway.
So as they leave the store... after his mother has put 98 of the 150 kroner on the counter for the suit for Trond, he says, "Can I keep it on?" And both people, the counterman and his mother, turned to him. They both turned and looked at me and nodded as one. He says, "I had my old clothes in a paper bag, which I rolled up and carried under one arm. When we were out on the pavement, walked on down to the station and to a cafe, perhaps for something to eat. My mother put her arm in mine, and we went on like that, arm in arm, like a real couple, light on our feet, our heights a match. She had a click in her heels that day that echoed from the walls on either side of the street. It was as if gravity was suspended. It was like dancing, I thought, although I had never danced in my whole life." And then the closing paragraph, "We were never to walk like that again. When we came home to Oslo, she fell back into her own weight, remained that way for the rest of her life. But on that day in Karlstad, we walked arm in arm down the street. My new suit fitted my body so lightly and moved with me every step I took. The wind still came icily down between the houses from the river, and my hand felt swollen and sore where the nails had pierced the skin when I clenched it so hard. But all the same, everything felt fine at that moment. The suit was fine. The town was fine to walk in along the cobblestone street. And we do decide for ourselves when it will hurt." And that truly is the lesson of the book. He's sort of separating himself from his own hurt in that book. But you don't feel that way, dear.
No, I did that scene with the mother. I really liked. I thought that was a very powerful. And that was the first time where I thought, I understood who these people were. Mm. I understood her, mm. you know, her love, and the fact she almost blushes when he comes out because he's so yeah. beautiful. And he's so and he's yes. so athletic. I did like the sense of the pleasure he took in his own strength. You know, the lumber, the young being 15 years old and alive. I got that. But I have to say, I don't think that Lars ever could choose not to feel the pain of shooting his twin brother. I thought that John could never feel the pain. I mean, to me, no, I don't think you can choose when you feel the pain. I think that's a delusion. I think that the two twins, their lives have been wrecked by an accident. Because I do get the sense John was not, he didn't leave the rifle out. You know, by deliberately, it was a mistake.
It was,
and the thing that you have the tool to shoot your no one, you can't choose to put that someplace else.
Well, I was just thinking. There's one thing. I actually met Pedersen several months ago, and he said something really interesting. He said when he's writing fiction, he says you don't know that you've really done it until it hurts inside. And this is a book that I think very clearly really hurt inside, and as a couple of his other ones have, and.
Did he ever marry again?
Oh, Pedersen's married, sure.
He is married.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this really is a work of the imagination.
No,
oh.
But you told me, you said yeah. early on in the program that his own family members.
No, his father and mother, his sister.
His father and mother.
Father, mother, brother, and a niece. No.
Right.
No.
So. Okay, fine. Let's go now to William in Gainesville, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
How are you today?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to ask a question. The term Quisling, I believe, was our Norwegian origin. Is that correct?
Eric.
That is correct.
It is correct.
And something we're not that proud of in Norway. It has become an expression. It's after the man Vidkun Quisling, who cooperated with the Germans and was put in as the first, I would say, prime minister of Norway after the occupation. So he collaborated with the Germans, basically.
So it's come to stand for collaboration.
Yes, so Quisling has become a general term for that.
Does that answer it, William?
Yes, ma'am, it certainly does.
All right, thanks for calling. And now to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Maureen, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to say that I read this book and I thought it was magnificent. It's not just a man's book or a woman's book, and it very much did remind me of old Norwegian literature. I remember reading Knut Hamsun 30 years ago, and I spent about a month last summer reading a lot of plot-driven Henning Mankell and Stieg Larsson, and they were a lot of fun for summer. And then I read Per Pedersen, and I was blown away. I was moved so deeply. And I liked the fact that it was not plot-driven, that it echoed real life. I watched my father die, and I remember him waking up in the morning and looking at the things next to his bed and wondering, should they be in a different order? Should they be different? But everything rang true about it. And in response to the lady that said, good people don't do things like that, good people do unforgivable things all the time. And I think because of that, the book rang very much true to me. Mm. And I highly recommend it.
Thanks so much for calling, Maureen. Any comment?
Oh, I just had one thing I wanted just about the book itself. I wanted to mention. We had talked about the war and about these and about the coincidence. One thing I never really quite, I just noticed on my second reading that Kdran's mother had two brothers who were also twins, and one of the twins was shot by the Nazis. So it goes on and on. And
that
and
goes to yeah. Deirdre's point about the coincidences
yeah.
and how they keep coming around. But as you said, in a country of 3 million, perhaps these
five
things,
to be correct, just
5 million. Yeah. No,
it's grown.
Well, I must say, you've provided lots of people with good fodder for this particular book. I thank you for reading Out Stealing Horses, Jeffrey Frank, Deirdre Donahue, and Eric Hofton, and for being here with us today. Thank you. And for next month's Reader's Review, A Story of Grief, Globalization, and an Unlikely Friendship, It involves a 16-year-old orphan, a well-off British couple, and a violent incident on a Nigerian beach. So please join us for the discussion of Little B by Chris Cleave. And that comes up Wednesday, May 26th. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.